We have two very interesting stories today, that of Naaman and that of the 10 lepers. Both involve more than simply healing. The account of Naaman begins with what might seem like a routine report of an important person with an important person, an important problem. He's a man, a mighty warrior, a great man, but he suffered from leprosy. In an ironic twist that's characteristic of the God of the Old and New Testaments, Naaman's salvation from his affliction comes from the very people Naaman oppressed. Among his household slaves was a young girl from the land of Israel. The girl had been enslaved during one of the raids into Israel, and the girl turns out to be the catalyst of Naaman's salvation. Note the power differential. On the one hand, there's Naaman, the great man and mighty warrior, favored by the Lord with victory. On the other hand, an enslaved young Israelite girl. The vast chasm in social power and standing between the two is reminiscent of the power gaps between, let's say, Pharaoh and the Hebrew midwives, or Jacob and Tamar, or indeed Pilate and Jesus. And as is so typical in the theology of the cross, the Spirit of God stirs among the lowly and brings salvation from the bottom upward. The girl informed her mistress that the prophet who is in Samaria could cure Naaman's leprosy. So Naaman set out to seek the prophet's aid. And here our reading skips verses, which explain what the letter referred to in our reading is, and also underscores how the great man of power thinks. Because Naaman brings with him 10 talents of silver, 6,000 shekels of gold, and 10 sets of garments, a vast sum of wealth. The point is that Naaman, a man of power, thinks like a man of power, victorious according to the ways of the world, and yet captive to its ways of thinking. He believes that the issue is wealth and power, and proceeds on the assumption that salvation and healing are to be bought. The letter of introduction he bears from the king simply underscores that point. The limits of earthly power, however, are revealed in the next scene by the reaction of the king of Israel. When the king read the letter, he tore his clothes, an extreme act when you think about every single garment had to be made from scratch, a long and painstaking process, and exclaimed, "Am I God to give death and life?" And there it is. Am I God? No. We see the limits of earthly power and wealth. Neither the king of Aram nor the king of Israel may give life, nor can Naaman's wealth and influence buy life. Only God can grant life in the face of death, health in the face of incurable illness. But the prophet Elisha, upon hearing of the letter, sent word to the king, "Why have you torn your clothes? Let him come to me, that he may learn that there is a prophet in Israel." In the next scene, the difference between God's way of thinking and the world's way of thinking are further illuminated. Naaman, with his horses and chariots and everything he brought, went to the prophet. But Elisha did not even bother to see the great man. Rather, he simply sent out word, "Go wash in the Jordan 7 times, and your flesh shall be restored, and you shall be clean." Livid, the great man began to rant. He stormed off in a rage. But Naaman's servants, again the lowly, caution and counsel him. "Father, if the prophet had commanded you to do something difficult, would you not have done it?" Note again, the chasm between the world's way of thinking and God's way of thinking. The world's way thinks that these things matter to God and salvation. You know, war horses and chariots and generals and kings and letter of introduction from the influential, wealth and complicated religious rituals, better rivers and waters. And those who are successful according to the ways of the world may think such things matter to and will influence God, but they do not. Only the lowly and godly can see how God works. The young enslaved girl can see, the general's servants can see, the prophet can see. In other texts, the widow, the orphan, the foreigner can see. The crucified one, above all, knows and embodies the way God works. God is not moved to act by complicated rituals or by golden bribes, by the influence of the powerful, by the power of the military, or the quality of water and wine. God is moved to act because God is God. God will save whom God chooses to save. Naaman followed the prophet's directions and he was healed. And note the gospel irony. His flesh was restored like the flesh of a young boy. We have that masculine equivalent to the young girl whom the great man had enslaved and from whom his salvation began. How ironic. How wonderful. It makes one laugh like Sarah and asks, is anything too wonderful for the Lord? Similarly ironic, amid the various ecclesial, ethical, liturgical reforms of the 16th century, Martin Luther was once asked to describe the true nature of true worship. His answer, the 10th leper turning back. Paying attention to a few details will help us appreciate Luther's insight into Luke's unique story. First, given that Samaria and Galilee border each other, there is no region between them. And even if there were, it would be an odd route to take toward Jerusalem. It may be that Luke was geographically challenged, but tend to think his point is theological rather than geographical. Jesus is on his way to Jerusalem, to the cross, and the encounters he has along the way reveal something about the nature of the kingdom he will establish there. This encounter happens in a middle space where one would expect the tension between ethnic and religious differences to be palpable. What God inaugurates through Jesus is made manifest in this region between. And now much of what happens in this brief scene is fairly typical. Neither the pattern of healing, a plea followed by an observable command, nor the response of worship from the one who returns to praise and thank and prostrate himself is unique. Both are reliable elements in healing stories. So God acts in and through the ordinary. But against this backdrop, a couple details stand out. Given that Jesus has commanded the 10 to follow the law, his question seems a tad disingenuous. Where are the other 9? I mean, we might answer, well, they're going to show themselves to the priests in accordance to the law, just like you told them to do. So why does Jesus ask? And the one who returns is a Samaritan, or as Jesus describes him, a foreigner. That is, one a first century Jew would not normally look to as an example. So amid the ordinary, something has changed. And then Jesus says to the Samaritan, your faith has made you well. One might also translate it as Eugene Peterson does in The Message, your faith has healed and saved you. Or, in the King James Version, your faith has made you whole. However we translate it, one thing is clear. There is more at stake here than mere healing. Taken together, these details orient us to the possibility that Jesus instructs his followers then and now that faith is not a matter of believing only, but also of seeing. All the lepers were healed. One, however, saw, noticed, let what happened sink in, and it made all the difference. Because he sees what has happened, the leper recognizes Jesus, his reign, his power. Because he sees what has happened, the leper has something for which to be thankful, praising God with a loud voice. Because he sees what has happened, the leper changes direction, veering from his course toward a priest to first return to Jesus. In this light, this story serves as an invitation to believers, then and now, to recognize that what we see makes all the difference. In the face of adversity, do we see danger or opportunity? In the face of human need, do we see demand or gift? In the face of the stranger, do we see potential enemy or friend? And it goes further. When we look to God, do we see stern judge or loving parent? When we look to ourselves, do we see failure or beloved child? When we look to the future, do we see fearful uncertainty or an open horizon? There is, of course, no right answer to any of these questions. How we answer depends upon what we see. Yet how we answer dramatically shapes both our outlook and our behavior. Perhaps this is the key to, for example, stewardship campaigns. Because stewardship is not first about giving, but about seeing all that we have been given and rejoicing in a way that cannot help but shape how we act. Perhaps this is also the key to the worship we carefully plan and tend week in and week out. Worship is not simply about hearing God's story or even praising God in response. Rather, hearing the story and praising through song and gifts is all intended to help us see God at work in our lives and the world. Perhaps this is even the key to the Christian life. Before we are called to believe or confess or help or do, we are called simply to see. And to help others do the same. We are called, that is, to point out blessing, to claim mercy, to name grace wherever we are and with all the courage we can muster. At the outset of this story, 10 men are stuck. They live between regions in a no man's land of being socially, religiously, and physically unclean. By the end of the story, all 10 are made well. But one has something more. He has seen Jesus, recognized his blessing and rejoiced in it, and changed his course of action and behavior. And because he sees what has happened, the leper is not just healed, but is made whole, restored, drawn back into relationship with God and humanity. In all these ways, he has been, if we must choose a single word, saved. What is true stewardship, worship, and Christian living? It's the 10th leper turning back. For now, as then, seeing makes all the difference. Thanks be to God.